Welcome to the Man of God Network, a podcast ministry of Covenant Baptist Theological Seminary in Owensboro, Kentucky. This is the voice of the narrated Puritan that can be found at puritanaudiobook.com or on Sermon Audio on a search for the narrated Puritan. The following Sunday school lesson was given before a live audience in Jenison, Michigan in 2019.
I'm going to start with some Bible verses in Matthew 18, and I want you to keep them in the back of your mind. I'm not going to right away tell you why I've chosen this text, but keep it in your mind and we'll apply it to what I'm about to say. And I'm going to start with verse 25 of Matthew 18. But for as much as he had not to pay, his Lord commanded him to be sold, and his wife and children. So this is a man with a big debt, and all that he had in payment to be made. The servant therefore fell down and worshipped him, saying, Lord, have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. Then the Lord of that servant was moved with compassion and loosed him and forgave him the debt. But the same servant went out and found one of his fellow servants which owed him 100 pence. And he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, pay me what thou owest. And his fellow servant fell down at his feet and besought him, saying, have patience with me, and I will pay thee all. And he would not, but went and cast him into prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw what was done, they were very sorry and came and told their Lord all that was done. In Thoughts on the Present Revival of Religion, there's a paragraph by Jonathan Edwards that is so instructive. There's counsel in Thoughts on the Present Revival of Religion that I think is almost unequaled in the English language. And he's here talking about the subtlety of the devil. The devil has driven the pendulum far beyond its proper point of rest. And when he has carried it to the utmost length that he can, and it begins by its own weight to swing back, he probably will set in and drive it with the utmost fury the other way, and so give us no rest, and if possible, prevent our settling in a proper medium. What a poor, blind, weak, and miserable creature is man at his best estate. We are like poor, helpless sheep. The devil is too subtle for us. What is our strength? What is our wisdom? How ready are we to go astray? How easily are we to be drawn aside into the innumerable snares? Well, in the meantime, we are bold and confident and don't doubt, but we are right and safe. We are foolish sheep in the midst of subtle serpents and cruel wolves and don't know it. Oh, how unfit are we to be left to ourselves, and how much do we stand in need of the wisdom, the power, the condescension, patience, forgiveness, and gentleness of our good shepherd. The year is approximately 1636, and there was a lady named Mary Dyer, born Mary Barrett, born in the year the King James Bible was produced, 1611. In 1635, she sailed from England to New England with her husband, William. The Dyers joined a Boston church pastored by John Cotton. Now, the Boston church pastored by John Cotton was originally pastored by John Wilson. And that's where there's a controversy that comes in. In attendance, you have not only the governor of Massachusetts, John Winthrop, but a lot of the leading officials of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in this single church. During the earliest days of the Boston Church, before the arrival of Mary and William Dyer, there was a single minister, John Wilson, in 1633. But in 1633, one of England's most noted Puritan clergymen, John Cotton, arrived in Boston and quickly became the second minister. In time, the Boston parishioners could sense a theological difference between Wilson and Cotton, and this in history became known as the Great Antinomian Controversy. If you were to go on Sermon Audio and look up Ian Murray, he has a sermon on this called the Assurance Controversy of 1636. But Murray is very charitable to John Cotton in this. But Anne Hutchinson took sides. She and another man had listened to John Cotton preach after they had listened to Wilson and thought Cotton was preaching more of the covenant of grace and Wilson more illegal works. And Mary Dyer became somewhat of a student of Cotton. So differing religious opinions within the colony eventually became public debates and erupted into what has traditionally been called the antinomian controversy. So many members of this Boston church, they thought Wilson's emphasis on morality and his doctrine of evidencing justification by sanctification to be disagreeable. And Hutchinson told her followers that Wilson lacked the seal of the Spirit, because Hutchinson had this idea, according to Romans 8:16, misinterpreted, that you will know that you're a Christian if you receive a direct sealing of the Holy Spirit. You do not determine that you are a Christian as evidenced in the fruit of the new birth or regeneration. And that would be okay if she would have kept her opinions to herself, but in her own home, she started to have Bible studies. And there were two Bible studies, but at the one that she said she was involved, only women were present. But she was brought up for examination, and they determined that there were men present. Well, my question about that is, so what? I mean, this isn't a church. You may have some really neophyte men believers who want to receive instruction, and she gives them instruction. I don't think personally that that's where the error was. But the problem was the church and the state were too much combined. So now we have an interesting thing, because Mary Dyer has become somewhat of a student of Anne Hutchinson. And Anne Hutchinson gets excommunicated. And as she's walking out of the church, Mary Dyer is somewhat of her disciple. She walks up with her and holds her hand and walks out with her, and gums start to flap. And they say, well, who is that? And somebody said, that's Mary Dyer, the woman that had the monster baby. So what is a monster baby? First of all, here's the two pastors. You have John Wilson on the left, John Cotton on the right. The monster baby. In the spring of 1637, Mary Dyer was again pregnant, expecting her third child. Labor occurred suddenly while Dyer was in the seventh month of her pregnancy. On October 17th, both Anne Hutchinson. Now, Anne Hutchinson also was a midwife. So there were two midwives there. So that's what Anne Hutchinson did on the side. But in this case, what she was mostly doing was bringing comfort to this lady who was expecting, who was giving birth 2 months prematurely. And the other midwife was a lady named Jane Hawkins. They were called to assist. Hawkins, another of the attendees at Hutchinson's meetings, was known as a cunning woman, skilled in the use of medicinal practices and potions. Other women, friends, and neighbors gathered at the Dyer house to offer what help they could. When Hutchinson arrived, she sought to comfort Mary, verified that all was in order, and no doubt offered Dyer words of godly assurance. Hawkins did an external exam and checked on the position of the infant. She determined that things were not well. Although there had been life in Dyer's womb only a few hours before, all signs of it had ceased. Moreover, this would be a breech birth. That's when the baby will emerge buttocks first. Dyer's travail wracked the bed. Hawkins reached into Dyer's womb to reposition the child. A necrotic odor pervaded the room, sickening all but the hardiest of those in attendance. By the time the birthing was complete, only Hutchinson, Hawkins, and one other woman, and they don't know who this other woman was, it's not recorded, who was now asleep, they remained in the room. The tiny body of Dyer's stillborn daughter was profoundly malformed. Most of the head was missing, with a face positioned nearer to the chest and both the hands and feet severely deformed. Anne Hutchinson knew well what condemnation this tragic birth would elicit in this Puritan society. So stillborn babies in a society like that, in those old days, that happened continually. That was no big deal. You wrapped the baby in some kind of cloth and you gave it somewhat of a grave. But this is a malformed baby, and there's so much superstition that Hutchinson knows when this word gets out that people are going to say this is a condemnation of God. They're going to misinterpret it. And so they know they have a problem on their hand. And Anne is a God-fearing woman, for all of her theological mistakes, I still believe this is a woman who feared the Lord. And she knew that John Cotton, even though there had been some controversy, was still a humble, charitable pastor, and she wanted to go to the pastor to get advice. What do we do? Because if this gets out, it's going to be turned against Mary. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, it already was, this church was only 7 years old, but there were already rules in place that were stricter than England, and all babies, even if they died stillborn, had to be recorded. But they didn't want this recorded, and John Cotton had his reasons for going along with that. He had been through this before, even in England. And he asked himself, well, what would I do if this is my child? I would want to be charitable. But Massachusetts law seeking to deter abortions and infanticide required that all births be publicly registered. In any case, Dyer's pregnancy was public knowledge. Well, we don't know. Who reported about this stillborn baby? Was it the third person in the room? Did John Cotton, the pastor, communicate something to his wife? Somehow word got out. And so when Anne Hutchinson was excommunicated and she's walking out and people are talking about Mary Dyer, they talk about her being the mother of this deformed baby. And it gets the attention of the governor of Massachusetts, which is really interesting in this respect. The governor of Massachusetts discovers what's going on here, and he wants to interrogate. He wants to find out what happened, and he realizes the pastor is involved, and he wants to interrogate the pastor. I would say that's a problem because you have the governor of the state and his own pastor, and he's interrogating his own pastor for this, which really isn't a scandal, but in those days, they made it so. How is you, as the governor of the state, do you go up to your own pastor and accuse him and interrogate him and so on? So the whole thing, to me, looking 400 years later, admittedly, is a very ugly scene. So once Winthrop had learned of the monstrous birth, he confronted Jane Hawkins and, armed with new information, then confronted John Cotton. As the news spread among the colony's leaders, it was determined that the infant would be exhumed and examined. They're going to dig the infant up and they're going to look at it. I mean, the lady's already in grief. She's lost her child and they're going to dig this child up and have an examination. So a group of above 100 persons, including Winthrop, Cotton, Wilson, and the Reverend Thomas Weld, went to the place of burial and commanded to dig up and behold this baby, and saw it a most hideous creature, a woman, a fish, a bird, a beast, all woven together from the book by John Windsor on William Dyer, Quaker Light and Puritan Ambition in Early New England. But listen, from Winthrop's own journal, and I can't but think as I read this that this is embellished. All right, this is a hideous birth. This wasn't nice to look upon, but this has to be embellished, and I wonder why. It just adds to the scandal. He writes, and by the way, Winthrop's journal's available on the Amazon Kindle for 99 cents. I copied and pasted this right out of his journal. The baby, it was of ordinary bigness. It was a regular size. It had a face, but no head, and the ears stood upon the shoulders and were like an ape's. It had no forehead, but over the eyes, four horns, hard and sharp. Two of them were above 1 inch long, the other two shorter, the eyes standing out and the mouth also, the nose hooked upward, all over the breast and back, full of sharp pricks and scales like a thornback. The navel and all the belly, with the distinction of the sex, were where the back should be, and the back and hips before, where the belly should have been. Behind, between the shoulders, it had two mouths, and in each of them a piece of red flesh sticking out. It had arms and legs as other children, but instead of toes, it had on each foot three claws, like a young fowl with sharp talons. This baby had talons like an eagle? So, she's already received this scandalous news. Winthrop has examined this baby. It's not good. But providentially, they go on. She has been banished, basically, to Rhode Island. But she, in time, returns to England. And the reason she goes there and why she left her kids, I don't know. But she had heard that Charles I had just been put to death. By the way, Charles I of England was decapitated, Thomas Goodwin was in the audience and was so appalled at what he saw that they would chop off the head of a king, he fainted. It was just an amazing time in the 17th century, but she thought that with Charles I gone and now you don't have a monarchy, maybe there's people she could communicate with. And some people thought maybe she had relatives who were part of the monarchy or... But anyway, she stayed there for 4 years. In the meantime, while she's in England, Oliver Cromwell and his army started passing laws. He was a staunch Presbyterian, where Quakers and Baptists were being persecuted, and this got into New England. And in 1655, so we move ahead from 1636, 1637 to about 1655, and the first Quakers were starting to come to America, and there weren't really any rules against them at first, but it changed very quickly. And by 1658, a new law was passed in the Massachusetts colony that introduced capital punishment. Quakers would be banished from the colony upon the pain of death, meaning they would be hanged if they defied the law. So here was the order. We catch you one time, we cut off an ear. You don't leave, we catch you again, we're going to stick a stake right through your tongue. We catch you a third time, we will hang you. That's how bad this has gotten. And Mary Dyer had become a Quaker, but a God-fearing woman who knew that what she was seeing was unjust. William, her husband, was a very gracious man, but didn't have the spiritual zeal that his wife had. And he took up residency in Rhode Island, and Mary stayed behind in Boston, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and also spending time in Salem. In June 1659, Robinson and Stephenson were once again apprehended and brought back to the Boston jail. So these were the people that they called. They became the Boston martyrs. There's the two governors, Winthrop, who by this time had passed away, and John Endicott, who was far worse and far more intolerant to the Quakers and also to the Baptists. Long before this, Roger Williams had already been banished to Rhode Island. So you had these people who became known as the Boston Martyrs. But what happened when Dyer heard of these arrests? These men were arrested. She once again left her home in Newport and returned to Boston to support her Quaker brethren, ignoring her order of banishment and once again being incarcerated. They threw her in jail. Her husband had already come to Boston 2 years earlier to retrieve her from the authorities, signing an oath that she wouldn't return. I'll keep her from coming. But he wouldn't come back to Boston. On 30th of August, 1659, he sat down to write a long and impassioned letter to the magistrates. Please, please, I'm pleading for my wife. Please, could you spare her? Questioning the legality of the actions taken by the Massachusetts authorities. On the 19th of October, Dyer, Robinson, and Stephenson were brought before Governor Endicott, where they explained their mission for the Lord. The next day, the same group was brought before the governor, who addressed the group. We have made many laws and endeavored in several ways to keep you from among us, but neither whipping nor imprisonment nor cutting off of ears nor banishment upon pain of death will keep you from among us. We don't want you here. You're Quakers. We don't tolerate you. You get out of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing in light of what I had already said last week when John Winthrop came here as a governor and preached this famous sermon that was called A Model of Christian Charity, A Light Upon a Hill. And that charity extended to the Puritans and to their successors and to their families. It didn't extend to the Quakers and the Baptists. Hearken now to your sentence of death, they said. William Robinson then wanted to read a prepared statement about being called by the Lord to Boston, but the governor would not allow it to be read, and Robinson was sent back to prison. Marmaduke Stephenson, being less vociferous than Robinson, was allowed to speak, and though initially declining, he ultimately spoke his mind and then was also sent back to jail. When Dyer was brought forth, the governor pronounced her sentence. Mary Dyer, you shall go from hence to the place from whence you came and from thence to the place of execution, and there be hanged till you are dead. She replied, the will of the Lord be done. When Endicott directed the marshal to take her away, she said, yeah, and I joyfully go. Now, she had gotten a reprieve, and she actually was allowed out for a while, and she rejected a reprieve. I'm not going to say anything about being guilty here. I'm not guilty. And she was hanged. So let's talk about the Baptists, Obadiah Holmes, John Crandall, and John Clark. And a lot of people attribute Roger Williams's starting the first Baptist church in America. And we don't know about John Clark. It was actually John Clark in Rhode Island with him. But these couple of names have been forgotten in history. Clark was born in 1609 and died in 1676. He was a physician, a Baptist minister, and co-founder of the colony of Rhode Island and Providence plantations. He was born in Suffolk, England, and he came to America. He came to the church. It was during the middle of the antinomian controversy he realized very quickly that he was not welcome. Obadiah Holmes, 1610 to 1682, was an early Rhode Island settler and a Baptist minister. The antinomian controversy ultimately resulted in many people leaving Massachusetts Bay Colony either voluntarily or by banishment. So Obadiah Holmes with his wife Catherine and son Jonathan arrived in Boston in 1638, bringing with him the tradition, says, the first clock ever brought to America, pendulum clock. He soon went to Salem, Massachusetts, and then he removed to Rhode Island after he determined he wasn't welcome. So there was now a church that was formed in Rhode Island. And Obadiah left Massachusetts disliking the rigidity of the established church there, and he was inclined to keep silent in the midst of the religious controversy. Now let's move forward. There's a blind man in Massachusetts Bay Colony who has Baptist leanings, who writes to Obadiah Holmes and John Clark and says, I can't possibly relocate to Rhode Island. Would you come here and minister to me? And they were moved with compassion. John Clark, John Crandall, and Obadiah Holmes journeyed from Newport into Massachusetts, coming to the town of Lynn on the 19th of that month. The purpose of the visit was to bring spiritual comfort and communion to William Witter, a blind and aged fellow, whose purpose was, of course, an evangelical one, to tell of the new baptism proclaimed, the new baptism and its import to all who would hear. And indeed, the word was proclaimed. Converts were baptized, believing converts, believers, baptism. This is a scandal. The elements of the Lord's Supper were served, all of this done privately in William Witter's home. But on Sunday, July 20th, two constables entered the house. With their clamorous tongues, they interrupted Clark's discourse, telling us that they were come with authority from the magistrates to apprehend us. Clark asked to see the authority for so rude an intrusion, whereupon they plucked forth their warrant, and one of them, with a trembling hand, read it to us. The three Rhode Islanders were placed under arrest and taken to the local alehouse, Anchor Tavern, to be fed and to await their scheduled appearance before the local magistrate, Robert Bridge, early the next morning. One of the constables suggested to the three prisoners that if they were free, then all might go together to the Lynn Church for evening services. John Clark replied that if they were free, none of this awkwardness would have happened. In other words, there's no freedom here. If we can't worship, if we can't witness to this man, there's no freedom here. What are you talking about, freedom? On the way, Clark informed the constable that if forced to attend your meeting, we shall declare our dissent from you both by word and gesture. Believing this to be a problem for sacred officers, not civil ones, the constable held his peace. Upon entering the church where services were already underway, the three visitors took off their hats, civilly saluted, sat down, and put their hats back on. Well, what's the custom? The custom is you remove your hat when you're in a worship service. What does it mean that your hat's back on? This isn't a worship service. We have no respect for what you're doing here. So they're taking a stand against what is going on in this church. So a trial before the general court began 1 week later. The trial itself was so swiftly consummated that the accused hardly knew it was done. It says, we were examined in the morning, wrote John Clark, and sentenced in the afternoon. So the order, if I remember right, so John Crandall was fined £5 and John Clark was fined £20 and Obadiah Holmes £30, possibly because he was more outspoken. And because they refused to accept the punishment, somebody had actually pressed into the constable's hands the money to release him. So two of them got off, and Obadiah Holmes says, I'm not going to hear of this. I haven't done anything wrong. I don't accept your sentence. The penalty which the law provided was banishment, but what sort of punishment is it to banish persons who already live in another jurisdiction? They were not without friends and sympathizers, however. The friends of Clark and Crandall speedily raised the amount of their fines and paid them. The fine of Holmes was higher and required a little more time to raise the amount, but his friends were ready to pay it. When he learned what they were proposing to do, he promptly forbade the payment of the fine, making it a matter of his conscience and scruples, but also knowing he was about to be whipped. Whipped 30 times. It was the same punishment you received for stealing and some of the more heinous crimes. And what's his crime? He's a Baptist. So Crandall put up his bail and went home. Holmes remained in prison, adamantly refusing to pay his fine. So he was whipped, and he prayed, God, give him grace. And the strokes did not follow each other quickly or lightly. They were laid on slowly and with all the strength of the officer wielding the instrument of torture. Now, some people that were examining this as he was whipped so bad that blood poured down his back into his boots. And yet God gave him such grace that when he was done, when he had been whipped, he says, you whip me as with roses. However, for the next couple of weeks, 3 weeks, in some ways, the rest of his life, he felt that whipping. It was so bad, he could not sleep on his back or his stomach. He slept on his knees and on his elbows. The blood would have mixed into the sheets. It would have been a mess. He couldn't even sleep normally. Somebody's there present in the room, and this is interesting. A man named Henry Dunster, the second president of Harvard College. And he's watching what's going on. And when they saw the heroic spirit in which Clark received this whipping, two people came up to shake his hands. And they both received punishment. And Dunster saw this. The president of Harvard was in the audience and became a Baptist after what he witnessed. And it was a crime to have a baby and not have it baptized. Because in those days, the church and the community were all one, somewhat like in England. You have a parish, not just a church. So Dunster abandoned the Puritan view of infant baptism in favor of believers' baptism in 1653 and 54. He provoked a controversy that highlighted two distinct approaches to dealing with dissent in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And they replaced him as the president of Harvard for becoming a Baptist. After his release from jail, Obadiah Holmes returned to Newport and in 1652 succeeded Dr. John Clark as a pastor there. He became the second minister of the First Baptist Church in America, the church at Newport. While he claimed to have his companion have felt no pain during the incident, he was so cruelly whipped that his companion Clark wrote that in many days, if not some weeks, he could take no rest, but as he lay upon his knees and elbows, not being able to suffer any part of his body to touch the bed whereon he lay. Much later, Rhode Island's governor, Joseph Jenkins, wrote, those who have seen the scars of Obadiah Holmes' back, where the old man was wont to call the marks of the Lord Jesus, have expressed a wonder that he should live. The authorities issued a new warrant to rearrest Holmes, but his friends defeated the purpose by spiriting him away. Shortly after the incident, Roger Williams wrote a letter to Governor Endicott making an earnest plea for toleration in matters of conscience and religion, but the letter failed to accomplish its objective. Holmes returned to Newport, and when Dr. Clark left for England in late 1651, Obadiah Holmes succeeded him as a minister of the church until his death. 30 years later, there's a direct descendant of Obadiah Holmes, six generations later, direct descendant, Abraham Lincoln. So Roger Williams, when Williams found in his refuge a semi-fellowship with the English church and the Congregational Church is put under the control of the magistrates, he foresaw at a glance that corruption and persecution must work out in America the same results they had wrought in England. Now, what was Roger Williams' conviction? The civil authorities have no way to command people to obey the first table of the law. The second table of the law, that can be enacted by a code. But when the civil authority gets involved and they tell you how to properly worship God, Roger Williams says it's going to create problems. And so he started a controversy in writing with John Cotton. And he wrote what was called the Bloody Tenet of Persecution. And Cotton wrote it, read it and wrote back a treatise called The Bloody Tenet, Washed and Made White by the Blood of the Lamb. And Williams wrote again and said, The Bloody Tenet, his title, made more bloody. And so Williams was fighting what was going on. Now, whether he was a true Baptist, he certainly believed in believer's baptism and so on. But the one thing you can say about Roger Williams, he knew that what was going on in the Massachusetts Bay Colony was corrupt. So let's do an overview of what was going on there. As to the Quakers, the number who suffered fine, imprisonment or whipping in Massachusetts was about 30. 22 were banished on pain of death. If they returned, 3 had their right ear cut off and 4 suffered death by hanging. Those were the Boston martyrs. And this author says no sufficient excuse can be offered for these severities, but then he tries to explain it in light of the times, and I'm not sure he does so satisfactorily. Death by hanging because you're not a Congregationalist? Laws against the Baptists. The law against the Baptists was enacted in 1644. On November 4th, 1646, the General Court put forth the following explanation. The truth is, the great trouble we have been put to and hazarded also by these familistical and Anabaptistical spirits whose conscience and religion has been only to set forth themselves and raise contentions in the country did provoke us to provide for our safety by a law that all should take notice how unwelcome the Baptists should be to us, either coming or staying, but for such as differ from us only in judgment in point of baptism or other points of less consequence, live peaceably among us without occasioning disturbance. Just don't tell us your complaints. In 1644, a poor man by the name of Painter, for expressing an opinion against infant baptism, was tied up and whipped. In 1644, a law was passed providing for the banishment of Baptists from the colony. Warrants were issued against 13 persons whose only crime was showing some sympathy with Obadiah Holmes. In 1663, the First Baptist Church in Massachusetts was formed in Swansea near the line of Rhode Island, and 2 years after, the first in Boston. And a few months after the organization of this feeble church, their trouble commenced and continued with much severity for a number of years, and some of the members spent most of their time in courts and prisons. They were often fined, and finally the sentence of banishment was pronounced against them, which, however, they did not see fit to obey. The burden of all the complaints was that they formed a church without the approving ruling powers. In Maine, there were similar experiences. The First Baptist suffered slanders, abuse, and legalized tyranny, and persons who met with them for worship were repeatedly summoned before a magistrate and threatened with fines in case of future offenses. Fines as high as £10 were inflicted upon some. The First Baptist Church in Maine organized at Kittery in 1682, and they encountered storms, violence, obloquy, fines, and imprisonment. And in less than 1 year from its formation, the church was dissolved and its members scattered like sheep upon the mountains. Well, it was interesting because I'm preparing this stuff and I'm doing this research and I'm friends with a couple of people on Facebook that are having a discussion. And I'm following along and I didn't get involved because it wasn't something I was really interested in. And that is, in the case of one that he thought that our U.S. Constitution was sinful. And I said, this man lives in Virginia. He's of the same church that you guys just came from, RPCNA, but he's in Virginia. And I said, well, that seems kind of strong, but I didn't want to get into a debate. So I left it alone, and I'm doing some more studies, and then I discovered the name of John Leland. But it just stuck in my craw. The United States Constitution is sinful. So I asked him, is it the view of your church that you don't vote? And he said, it's not the view of my church, but I personally don't vote. And that's when he told me, he confirmed that he believed the U.S. Constitution was sinful. But I hadn't really studied it out. There was just something that was in the back of my mind that was really, really bothering me. And that was the verse in Ezekiel 9, verse 4, about the messenger of the Lord coming down upon the people and putting a mark upon those that sigh and cry for the abominations in the land. And I thought, and you won't vote. I said, I can't adopt that. Personally, I can't. I mean, it's our only way to express something that's given to us. Sure, we need to pray, but if the Lord gives us some way to make things right, at least for godly man to be put into authority. And as I'm studying, I come across the name John Leland, the Baptist. And Doug, where we were kind of confused, I was confusing him with John Ryland. Ryland was in England, and the senior Ryland was also against the founding of foreign missions, William Carey. But his son, John Ryland, was actually part of William Carey's mission. And John Leland was also against missions. So this wasn't a perfect man, but I thought that this was interesting because Leland was part of the group that would ratify the U.S. Constitution that was for the most part written by James Madison, and he wouldn't ratify it. In fact, he threatened to run against Madison at the time as a congressman, and Madison was disturbed at what's going on. Why won't this man ratify the Constitution? Madison was pretty young at the time, but he got together with John Leland, and Leland said, I can't ratify it without a Bill of Rights. And Patrick Henry was against a Bill of Rights, just the thought of it, because they didn't want the Constitution to become an instrument to give the government more power. But for Leland, the one thing that had to be in it was the things expressed in the First Amendment, and that is that the government, the state, should not form a church. And so I'm comparing this with what I'm hearing from my friend in Virginia, and I'm thinking, well, the reason that these Baptists, Leland was a Baptist pastor, wanted this in place, and I was reading some of his writings, and they are available online, that when people in authority start to make the laws of the land, especially according to only the first table of the law, because they're sinful, they become tyrants. And we need freedom. We need the liberty of expression. And I don't know how you feel about that, but what was going on in his mind was that atheist down the road, I may totally agree with what he is saying, but I'm going to support the right, the freedom of speech that he has to say it, because the government can't change the hearts of men. It has to come from God. And so I haven't researched this a lot, but after what I had read about what happened to our Baptist forefathers, I understand why Roger Williams was concerned about what was going on in colonial America. Pre-colonial America, and you can see why Leland had the concern that he had, because I only told you part of the story, but the Baptists were severely persecuted in this country.